Welcome to Be Reasonable, a podcast from the Merseyside Skeptic Society, hosted by Michael Marshall. In each monthly interview, we'll examine beliefs from outside of the mainstream, exploring how those views are constructed and what evidence people feel supports their case. We believe in approaching subjects with respect and an open mind, engaging with people of different viewpoints in an environment where debate is polite and good-natured, yet robust and intellectually rigorous. In this month's episode, I spoke with UFO researcher and alternative historian David Boyle. I began by asking David how he became interested in the areas he researches.
I'm 67 years of age. I've been involved in trying to find out the truth since I was 14 at school. My first paranormal style of experience was when I was 5 years of age. I then realized that a lot of what we were being told at school didn't match. We went out to check the information, particularly in archaeology, and being religious understandings. So I wasn't prepared, and I suddenly realized that we were only being taught information passed on by other people who hadn't actually investigated what they'd learned and passing it on. And I then realized that we learn information from many sources. One of the main sources we learn when we're young is our parents. Now, our parents, I believe, in 99% of the cases, pass on information to us that they think will be for our benefit. However, the information they've got, they haven't actually checked out.
Yeah, sure.
And when you start to realise this, they try to do the best for you, but you end up with this situation where they're only passing on information. And then you look at what you're being taught at school, and the main learning places where you should understand it, to find out that a lot of what we are told scientific theories tend to be that, just scientific theories. And the hard evidence doesn't seem to be there. And, of course, when you question your schools and your education authorities, as I did on a couple of occasions, I was told in the end, if you can't understand it, shut up, don't make a noise, don't interfere, but they couldn't answer the questions. So it was at that point I then realised things were not right. And then I evolved and left school and went on to my career, which has included vast amounts of things. I mean, I've run quarantine stations for the import and export of foreign birds, handling thousands. I had a large pet shop that we introduced, that we worked in the middle of Warrington. And then from then onwards, I evolved into quarantine. And then my hobby, of course, had been model railways for years. And then I decided, instead of doing what I didn't want to do, which was the quarantine and that, I would work my way into model railways. And I started to build, and my collection got bigger. I started to get to know all everything. And then I decided one day I'd like to try and produce my own. And then gaps started to appear in the existing market. And Airfix, who were overproducing, got into trouble. And I started to buy items, bits and pieces. I started, first of all, by buying full shops and organisations which were going bust. And a lot of model railway shops at this time were finding it very hard. So I would go in and buy lock, stock and barrel everything. And that was a good way to get going.
And it's true that you run the also the exhibition of the universe as well, don't you?
Yes.
That's kind of the area that I think our listeners are really quite would be really
interested,
quite interested
in. Nothing to model railways, I understand that. But I'm just trying to show you that I learned how to analyse everything, which is the important thing. I learned how to make things and strip them down to the bare necessities. Once you can analyse, you can then synthesise, you can put together. And I believe I was taught by the universe, right, and given so many jobs that I can now dismantle practically anything and rebuild it and make most of the things with my hand. This was a great advantage when you wanted to find out what was going on, because you could take away what I would consider the rubble that's added to the programmes and the inserts, and to define and get down to the core what's actually going on and what actually is the truth. And, of course, that came very close to me when I started to realise that the archaeology of the stones didn't match the stories. And when I questioned the people that I knew, who were supposed to be the authorities of it, school teachers, I even went to universities, and I've never actually been to, but I went to speak to university professors who were telling us about archaeology, and it was a lie. And I told them quite categorically that pyramids weren't tombs for pharaohs, because no pharaohs were buried in them. But why did the entire world? So then I realised that we were being only told what the people who control the world want us to know. And from that moment on, I went into the understanding, and I learned very quickly. I was very positively active in going to Egypt. I've done 3 trips, length and breadth of Egypt, with the most advanced of all the Egyptian archaeologists. His name was Abdul Hakim Awayan, and you can find him on the internet. And I have still 300 hours of his teachings without actually disposed or done anything with them yet. But I have worked and done a lot. I'm now going to tell you that what I suddenly found out was that the pyramids are not tombs of pharaohs, they're books in stone that contain all the knowledge of the people who wrote them at the time. It contains the information of the workings of the universe. But more important, attached to them were the temples. And each temple is a university of knowledge and truth, right? And then you start to see. I find out that the Great Pyramid is what we call volumetric awareness. And it makes all the measurements of time and space. And within it, we contain all the dimensions of everything that's made that we understand. And that's what pyramids are. And that's the last thing the people who control us want us to know. That pyramids contain this knowledge. So do the universities, which are their temples. And of course, across the world, we're now showing that decoding amongst all of the artifacts, you're finding stuff that doesn't fit into our technology or our beliefs of technology.
Could I just sort of take a focus on a couple of those things? I know there's a couple of things that you've highlighted elsewhere that you say don't fit in. And I think one in particular was a plate which seemed to suggest that there were tanks and helicopters from a time when there couldn't have been.
That's right. Well, in the time that you believe there couldn't have been,
yeah,
that's the big difference. This is on the Temple of Abydos.
Hmm.
Now, according to all our scientists, that temple was built sometime in the 2 to 3,000 BC. It's the temple of Seti the First. And Seti First is understanding. That temple was then extended by his son, Ramesses the Second. His son then went to extend it backwards, and at the back of the temple they discovered the Assyrian.
Hmm.
And then, instead of building over the Assyrian, they turned and made the only L-shaped temple in Egypt. The one at Abydos. And that temple contains the 7 steps to activate the consciousness of your mind. It's laid out in 7 levels. And to be able to access those levels, you have to have a basic understanding of how the universe works. And on that plate wall, I can tell you now, is that information that you're shown with a tank and a helicopter, right, is from a time period when there were nuclear wars. And I'm going to tell you now, your whole history is a lie. The archaeology of the stones doesn't match the stories.
And that we can come to the nuclear wars in just a moment, perhaps.
Yeah.
I'm particularly interested in that. So I took a look at the plate with the tank and the helmet,
yes,
things like that in preparation for the interview. And what kind of strikes me, I guess, is that it certainly the symbol on there does look a bit like a tank. But it is essentially a sort of large rectangle with a thin line kind of coming from the top and bending round. And I think if you're predisposed to think this is a tank, it certainly looks like it. But if you were predisposed to think it was something else, it could...
If you have an imagination, you can turn any lines and any boxes into anything you wish.
Yeah,
to.
Indeed.
Now, if I drew on the screen now in front of you a stick man, a circle with a bar down, 2 parts of arms and 2 parts of legs, is that a stick man? The answer is yes, because we see that. But it's actually only 7 lines, right? So you can adjust anything any way you want. What you don't know, and what nobody else tells you, is that plate is in the middle of a story.
Okay.
And each side of it is a full explanation of the story. And that story tells you a different part. It shows you how the councils of the Anunnaki met, right, and discussed what was going on. And the reaction from that was the causation of that plate.
Okay.
On the plate, you've got a helicopter, you've got other aspects. Now, I can read it through the rest of the plate. To the left-hand side, you've got the papyrus plant, which is what they use for everything. In Egypt, they made everything out of the papyrus plant, from paper to utilization, cloth, bits and pieces, and that was a representation then of a utility. To the left of that, you've got a big goose, right? And that goose, of course, is the earth, right? And then you've got the feminine aspects of it, the bee, showing it's the female. So we're talking of the earth, right? And then as you go through the plate, you'll see there's been 3 W's on it. And they have been overseen by 3 things that were chipped out in 3 off of 3. Those 3 W's, the W stands for foreigner. 2 W's means distant foreigner. and 3W means far distant, foreign, or extraterrestrial.
Okay, and if I just want to pause there for a moment, first of all, could you just go back to the goose? I think our listeners will just be wondering, and it's not being Egyptologists, why you say the goose, of course, means the Earth. Could you just kind of very briefly explain how that's...
You need to understand the story of the nine gods of the Aeneid. And they say that everything started from the same aspect, which is the same story of creation that's even interlinked in a different form within the Bibles and lots of other forms. They say that they started off with one, which divided itself into two, right? Mm-hmm. And they then divided into Nut and Jeb. Jeb being a goose, being the physical reality, and Nut being, of course, which followed on to become the movement across the sky, right, of the night goddess. So the Jeb became the earth part, which is the goose, which is the earth aspect.
Okay.
Right? So it shows you the earth and that. That's why there's a goose there.
Okay, right? Great. And then you have the three W's, meaning a foreigner from very far.
Far distant foreigners, yes. And you've got the helicopter and what could be a submarine. But you then have what looks like a flying vehicle with what could be a fin on the back of it. That's a vertical fin. Now, we can't identify that totally because obviously within the middle of that, there was something else that was chipped out of it that shows it. But underneath, you've got the Egyptian emblem for strength, right?
Okay.
And you can see that as like a wedge at the left as it's going along, and then a bump in the middle which represents muscle, right, at the bottom right-hand side of the plate. And that means the strength of the gods. So basically, when you look at the whole plate, it's interpreted from, this is the story of the council, of what the council, which is the cartouche in front of it, which is the council of the Anunnaki, including the hidden gods, right? And they're telling the story of what Seti the First did, right? Now, at the front of the temple as you're coming in, because it's not just the one plate, it's part of the other stories in the temple. As you enter in the front of the temple, in this preserved part that's still there, there are three gigantic statues, right? And the first one is Ramesses II. And in his hand, he has the goddess of truth, which is Mat. And he's handing that across to three characters. And the characters he's handing them over to are Osiris, Isis, and Horus, the divine triad of the humanity's consciousness. So he's telling the divine triad of the personality, which is the human race, Isis, who is the earth, and Osiris, who is the sun in the sky, the divine triad, right, what his father, Seti the First, did. And what his father did, Seti the First, was dropped the nuclear bombs on the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah.
Okay, could you explain how we, because obviously this is where our listeners who'd be of a fairly sceptical nature would, kind of step up and think, okay, nuclear bombs, Sodom and Gomorrah. We have the biblical story of Sodom and Gomorrah, and we know what the Bible, said about it.
Of course, so what does it say? What does it say in the Bible?
That God punished them, didn't he?
No, he didn't. Right? It goes in different versions, because unfortunately you've got many versions of the Bible. Mm. But basically it says, angels of the Lord appeared in a whirlwind. Now, if you hadn't seen a helicopter before, and it landed next to you in the sand, what would you say it was?
Okay, so...
And they got off and went to them and told them to take shelter in a cave. And they told them not to look back. But, of course, the woman was quite convinced that she had to look back. So she got out and went out. And as she entered outside to watch what was going on, the cities were destroyed in a flash with fire and brimstone. So how can you tell me, right, now, please forget, how can you destroy a whole city in a flash with fire and brimstone? And now you know your answer, don't you? Nuclear destruction. And for her pains, standing outside, she was turned into a pillar of salt. What happened to all the people who stood in the blast at Hiroshima and Nagasaki? They were vaporized, and all that's left is a pile of white powder that looks just like a pillar of salt.
And I think when you do take us through the story that way, it certainly does seem very
interesting. Well, it adds the knowledge onto it. Yeah, and if you go to Sodom and Gomorrah today, you'll find the remnants of the outer lines of the buildings are all coated in glass.
Yeah.
Right. Now, if you go to Wounded Nevada, where we'd set our own detonations and melted the planet, you've got the two styles of destruction. A ground bomb burst will produce a blast area, but then the heat is so intense it expands outwards and burns every single thing right down to the ground. And it melts the rock together and produces a circle of glass.
Mm.
And that's what you've got there. You've got the vitrified effects of the remains of their detonations on the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah.
Well, I think if you went to Nevada and did take a look at the test areas, you would find glass that's kind of well documented.
Of course you would.
You'd also find a very huge level of radiation which would be emitted from there, which presumably we don't get with Sodom and Gomorrah, which was inhabited, Sodom and Gomorrah was
so many thousands of years ago that radiation has dissipated in many cases.
Well, I think the radiation, the half-life would actually likely last an awful lot longer than that. But also, the areas of Sodom and Gomorrah would now make up the areas of the...
What about the two cities in Pakistan that they dug up, where the radiation levels is far higher, right, than any of the others in the aspects of the areas? And, of course, all the bones and the bodies that were found in the ground when they dug them all up, were at a much higher radiation level, which, of course, shows you a nuclear war that was there in about 5,000 BC. And, of course, you've written about that in the Bhagavad Gita and quite a few of the other Indian stories.
I think maybe perhaps part of the issue that many people who hear this story would have, and it kind of comes back to what you said very early on about you were at school and you found that the people who were telling you the stories, they hadn't investigated themselves or they didn't necessarily have
that
information. It's very hard to then go from that point to then saying, and now if we look at the story of Lot in the Bible, the story says that his wife was turned to a pillar of salt, and this therefore proves that she was vaporized in a nuclear blast.
I didn't say anything proved anything. I said it points towards it.
Yeah,
but then you add the other evidence to it, and the more evidence that you get to find it in the reality, you point to the fact that today the two cities have got glazed stones, vitrified-style stones created by intense heat, melting the thing right down to a level. Now, I mean, they tried to reproduce the vitrified forts in Scotland by building a fort and burning trees over it for 3 days. They just managed to blacken the stones. So the technology that turned that into vitrified areas in Scotland, in at least 65 forts in Scotland, right, finds out to be a higher level of technology than we possess at the present time. I might well say there could well be things like laser beam aspects. Because I'm going to tell you now, your whole history is a lie. We were far more technologically advanced in the past than we are today. The evidence of the building of the pyramids alone, we couldn't do that today. We couldn't move in the way that we say the stones that built Stonehenge. It's all rubbish. We were far more technologically advanced.
I mean, people have been able to replicate some of those things today. And in fact,
no, they haven't. Nobody has replicated the movement of the big stones at Stonehenge. They only use the small ones. And then they showed you the difficulty they had in trying to do that. They haven't done the big ones. It's like moving the statues on Easter Island. Mm. You only move a little tiny one. Nobody moves the great big ones and moves them into positions.
So do you believe that the statues from Easter Island came about in the same way that you're suggesting Stonehenge,
They were created by more advanced people in the past.
To what end?
To end, the statues, of course, would be a utilization of a form of religion. Of an understanding to have a higher power.
So when we say if we just park that for 1 second, we just come back to who these more advanced people were. Are you suggesting that these are extraterrestrial? I guess
the more advanced people in the past. Hang on a minute. What do you know of the pyramids that's been found in the Ukraine, in the Crimea?
Very, very little.
Okay. Do you know how old they are supposed to be?
I'm not aware of that. No.
There's 37 pyramids they found, which are buried underground. They're buried underground because the period of time that the dust has settled over the thousands of years, they're actually between 500 and 750 million years ago.
See,
all your stories of Adam and Eve and all of these aspects is all bunkum. It's all added on just for control of the mind, developed for us so that we could be controlled and attributed to those with the power.
And I think this kind of then raises a couple of questions. So if we were to take that, this is these facts are all absolutely true, and therefore it was extraterrestrials who did this. Going back to the Easter Island thing, first of all, it seems curious then that the extraterrestrials would, at the same time as using laser beams to melt rocks and all manner of technologies, you know, nuclear weapons to destroy cities, would also then decide to give us statues, very large statues for us to worship. It seems like that would be an odd scenario.
An odd way. It depends on what the aspects of. the people of Easter Islands were all of what's known. The history of that area tells you that was part of a place called Mu, the island of Mu. And the islands of those people there utilised a different, more spiritual style of life form than the technology advanced by the rest of the world. But there's quite sure we can show you remains of nuclear wars on this planet going back 180,000 years.
I think that would be a remarkable thing to demonstrate. The difficulty is, of course, that while we didn't, as a species, invent nuclear energy, we only learned to be able to control it or use it when we wanted to.
No, we don't control it. We utilize what it is.
We've been doing it. So if we then take the idea of, you mentioned Adam and Eve and how that's a story that we've been given to control us, it's worth asking then, given by who is this? By
the people
by
who control
man,
us. The people who control us. The people who today still hold the powers of wealth and power. The secret societies have a great deal more knowledge than they're prepared to share. Why do we have secret societies? We have secret societies so that the knowledge and wisdom that they've got can maintain the power and wealth of the people that hold the country's wealth.
Of course, the idea of a secret society and asking the question, why do we have it, is an intriguing question, because it does get to the question of how secret is a secret society if we can ask about why they exist. How do we know that the secret societies exist if they are, by their very definition,
not a secret? We know they exist because I've got an exhibition full of their regalia going back from many types and styles, from Masons to Knights Templars. I've got cabinets full of it.
And what kind of stuff have you got in the exhibition?
I've got swords, cabinets. In the cabinets, I've got hundreds of medals, sashes, aprons, swords, flags, all the different secret societies.
So,
it's regalia, it's there, it's not a case of whether they exist or not. Come and have a look, it's all there. You can go onto the internet and find masses and masses for sale of all the secret societies of the areas everywhere.
So these secret societies who do control the world, presumably they have a huge amount of power and an ability to control all manner of things.
Yes.
It seems then something of a blip in their all-encompassing power that they will leave artifacts that would allow someone to piece together their existence.
No. Listen, they become so big and so vast, you can't control every person that's individually. And the different ceremonies, as they're raised through their levels of understanding, they get different memorabilia and aspects. And when people die, what happens to the stuff that they've been wearing? You know, the people who married to them start to sell it off and to get any form of finance back. So you can find all this information. It's not a case of them deliberately having such a situation. They don't ban the people. The people wear all these things. But the secret societies are controlled by the fact that they won't allow you to know what's going on. A Mason at a higher level than 10 degrees was not allowed to speak to anybody else unless above a Mason of the same degrees. So the knowledge and wisdom stays in the highest level, and they swear unbelievable accounts to do it. And they're given lessons across the planet in how to follow it, right? I mean, do you remember the gentleman who was hung under the bridge in London?
I don't know.
Facing east as the tide came in. That's a prophecy saying to anyone who breaks an oath in a certain levels of the Masons that that will happen to them. And they had this Italian banker whose it was done to him exactly on the level. So every Mason that knows that will see what will happen to them if they do it. So consequently, it keeps them quiet. It doesn't let them allow them to share the information.
But it does strike me that these secret societies that are in control, if they are able to control so much, then it does seem like...
I wouldn't say the secret societies in control. I would say they're supporting the people that's in control.
Ah, so who is in control? Or who
the
are
people
in control?
The people who rule this planet right now? The multinational international corporations are dusted in the different cabals, which is a group of people who feel they rule the world. And the cabals are made up of the multinational military force systems, the royal family groups and leagues and elites, the dragon societies, and of course OPEC thinks it rules the world because it's got the control of the oil, and many others. And of course you've got the banking cartel that controls everybody else by the financial institutions.
So...
And many of these people in the cabals are intermixed with other cabals. So you're going to get several people who sit on different cabal groups and systems.
I think it's certainly a very intricate worldview.
Everything is connected. This is where people say to me, you can't talk about that because it's spiritual. You can't talk about that because it's nuts and bolts. Well, I can talk about any of them because they're all the same. They're all interlinked to the same stories. Mm. And when you find out how things work, you know that everything is linked together to everything. And there's nothing separate from anything else. If it's an experience you can feel mentally or physically, it's available for you.
And so how does the cabals who are in control, how does that relate to the extraterrestrials and the nuclear...
Well, they don't want you to know anything about it. They've been covering up the UFO aspects for years.
To what end?
The last thing they want you to do is expose the fact that all you've been told by your religions and your governments is a load of crap. And to say that understanding, they're making sure that anything that doesn't fit into their stories, they take away, right? You've got the energy cabal that controls power and understanding. They are stopping people from being done, from producing things that would be for the benefit of everyone. Because they're maintaining their money, their power and their wealth by protecting their incomes and their understandings. The people who rule the world aren't really individual. People seem to think it's American, it's British, it's Canadian. No, the people who rule the world at the very back, right, control of the financial institutions across the world and the pharmaceuticals, and nobody knows who they are because they make sure that they are only the top echelon passing on to the people that's beneath them. All the people who work for the government understandings. A policeman is not in charge of you. A policeman carries out the information that he's been told by his officers, right? So what he's told, he does. Like a soldier does what he's told. Because he's accepted that. He's given away his personal power by accepting orders from others. And many times he has to go out and commit heinous crimes because he's accepted the order and given away his personal power, even moralist and unmoralistic aspects. Right? So, of course, when you believe that you are not in charge and you let somebody else take control of you, you then become a tool for that other person.
And so if we just take a look at the groups who are in charge then, you know, you mentioned that the oil companies, I can understand how they would
OPEC,
they'd have a clear way of affecting charge.
Yeah,
you can understand the banking industry would have a clear way of affecting charge. You mentioned the royal family. It seems curious that these days the royal family seems to be largely little more than ceremonial and therefore,
ceremonies. Come on. You know better than that.
Have you got
a car?
I have got a car.
Have you? Is it yours?
Yes.
No, it's not.
In what sense?
Look at your logbook. It tells you you are the registered keeper. It belongs to the Crown.
Well, yes, but I don't believe there's any instances where the Queen has co-opted it.
Yet. Until she needs it. And the next question is, do you own a house?
I will do on Monday.
Okay, well, when you do, will you please note that you've got a lease from the Crown for 999 years. It's pretty old.
Okay, so in 999
And then what do you think the leasehold is on everyone else's property? It belongs to the Crown.
But again, is this not vestiges of the historical...
Of course it is. The reality of all the things comes back to the same aspect. We are subservient. Have you got your birth certificate?
Yes, I have somewhere. I haven't got
have you? No, you've not. You've got a copy.
Yes.
Because your birth certificate is held by this government as a security collateral to loans we've had from the International Monetary Fund. You are an asset of this country.
But I think that just goes back to the interconnectedness of us, which I think is...
I'm telling you, everything's in the same aspect. Everything is all connected.
But I think connectedness doesn't always necessarily imply malevolent control or design. Connectedness is just fundamentally the way that society structure themselves.
Well, everything's connected across to everybody and everything else. I've told you, everything's connected.
But
it doesn't have
to
be malevolent or unmalevolent, right? It doesn't have to be benign or malevolent, right? It's a reality that it's there.
Well, I think that's absolutely true, but I think for me, I would say that civilizations evolve in very much the same way that, that organisms evolve. You know, we have appendixes. Each of us has an appendix. It's useless, but it's there because it's a vestige of the time when we were a lower form, a different form of animal who would have needed an appendix.
Correct.
Similarly,
that's
I would say.
So where do you come from?
But if I was just to finish that thought through, and I'll come back to that in a second, because I feel we're going to go
somewhere. Your appendix is when you used to chew grass.
Yeah,
and it was there for extracting the chemical out of the food.
Absolutely, and similarly, the fact that the royal family owns my car and owns my house is a vestige of the fact that the royal family used to have power, but these days they are the appendix of our civilization.
Excuse me, when Bush, who was supposed to be the leader of the most advanced nation in the world, came over, who did he get on his knees to?
Well, indeed, but... And that, this is getting
indeed, no, indeed, that's the reality, I'm telling you. Now, I'm going to tell you, the royal families across the world, let's be straight on this, nearly every country in the past had a royal family. They're nearly all interbred with each other, totally in the same groups. And then you start to see, because, of course, you've now got even the royal families of Afghanistan are turning up again. And, of course, they're everywhere. Whether they hold the power or not, they're still the same members of the same royal families.
Well, I mean, that's...
And they still control... When they're not controlling the nations through the state, an awful lot of them are controlling the nations through the power of finance.
So in what way would you say that the royal family were controlling the UK through finance?
Okay, right. Who do the Americans pay their income tax to?
The government.
The FRS.
Okay.
Who owns the FRS?
I'm not sure.
Right. Okay, let's give you that. America had a war of independence being a colony from Britain. Who won the war?
Well, I'm about to say America, but I get the feeling you're going to tell me that's not true.
George III, who they said was a total raving lunatic, was a very clever man indeed. Right? Because what he did was this. When it became obvious that our troops didn't want to shoot each other, because most of them were British troops, right, and that we were in that situation, he made a great mistake. The first thing he did was to send over hussars from Holland and Germany. So the British ones and the Americans united against him.
Mm.
And then finally, right, at a battle, it was decided, and Cornwallis removed himself, wasn't defeated, left the field. So at that point, George III asked for a conversation, and they had a meeting. And they asked him what they wanted, and they wanted their own flag and their own constitution. He said, no problem at all.
Hmm.
Just sign the Royal Charter. And they agreed. So they got what they wanted, and George III got what he wanted, which was the Royal Charter. The Royal Charter created the FRS. The major shareholder of the FRS is the Crown. And just to make sure of that, let's tell you a little bit more about times it went on in the American understanding of the Revolution. Everyone thought George III was a bit of a nutter. He was a very clever man.
Mm.
You see, he sent his people to work on America. He was very upset about the rebelling. So he created a gentleman named John Brown. And John Brown, of course, created the war and started the slavery, knowing full well it would divide America between the North and the South. So to maintain control, right, as they started to fight each other, George III supported the Confederates and supplied him with arms and ammunition for lots and lots of military gear, right? At the same time, the Americans, the Union, asked the French to help them. And Louis helped them. He couldn't do it with himself because he got no money. So George III lent him the money to lend to North America. So the Unions fought the Confederates. The Confederates had borrowed the money from England, and the Unions had borrowed the money from France. And they knocked hell out of each other for a long time. And then finally, when it had all ceased, they decided to get together and create a new constitution. And the first thing of these people that were doing this, that wanted to do, they made sure that they stated without doubt that all the debts of both the Confederates and the Unions would be paid off. So who gained from that war?
So you're suggesting
and now
that,
you know, they were all used as puppets. George III manipulated them. Manipulated them, right, against each other, created the destruction, and gained from every aspect, making all the powder, all the guns, all the bullets and that for them, and the money being sent across to cover them was agreed to be met at the end. I wonder how long ago it was that he finally paid all them debts up. And that's your first story then you start to understand everything is controlled. The same people for thousands of years have been controlling all of the aspects on this planet. And we have wars. The First World War was a big problem. Right? I know we're going on and we're diversifying from many things. I mean, if you want to go back to talk about the Temple of Abydos, that's a wonderful one to talk about. Because that tells you how to activate the 80% of your brains we don't use. And of course, that also explains it all. It's all carved in stone on the wall. But you first got to understand how to decode them, which we've done. And we've decoded most of it now.
But even there, I think, what tends to happen, I think, what seems to be the case across many of the theories and the ideas that you're saying is that there are elements where there is cold hard fact, and then there are some assertive connections. So even, for example, you talk about the temple and how it tells you how to activate the 80% of our brain that we don't use. That statistic, which a lot of people will play it the other way and say you want to use 10% of your brain, they're going for 10 rather than 20%.
The average human being has been measured between 8 and 18%.
But that's not true. That's the issue is that this isn't a true statement. This is a canard that came up.
Of course it's common, but it falls within that parameters, doesn't it?
No, okay. This what I'm saying is actually if you understand the scientific literature, we use 100% of our brain because evolution is incredibly efficient.
No, we do not use 100% of our brain. It's deactivated. It's deactivated because you've got loads of DNA strands that are not connected. So it's been deactivated. Your mind's been switched off so you can learn lessons.
How do you mean DNA strands which aren't connected?
You have thousands of DNA strands in your body, which your governments and scientists call junk DNA, which are standard DNA strands that have not been connected.
Well,
and when they're connected, it will give you the greater utilization of the brain, mind and the brain. And that's what you think. Your mind has actually been switched off. Your brain is not your mind anyway, sorry. Your brain's been deactivated. You're only allowed to use between 8 and 18% of your brain. Right? Higher rates above that start to see into the worlds that you won't believe about. The worlds of, should we say, the psychics, the mediums, the channelers. The ability to see auras around people. Right? Which do exist because we can photograph them and show you that they're real. Right? And that shows you a totally different aspect. You've got to understand this. You've got to be careful. You've got to be sure that it doesn't have to be exactly right to the one degree. But the brainwave activity of ours is only minute. Right? The residue, most of our mind is inactive. And of course, when you realize that you decode the information that's coming into your eyes and your mind through your brain, which is not your mind, your brain is your receiver, right? That information comes in then for you to be able to discern, to work out what is correct and what is not correct. And at the same time, anyone wishing to control your consciousness level can prevent you from learning and seeing what's around you.
I think if I just come back to a previous statement of that, because I think what's really fascinating, and I do, I'm utterly fascinated by the various different elements of the conspiracy and the connections between them, but I'm also fascinated about how they begin to be put together and begin to come up. So if we go back to a moment, the idea of junk DNA, well, what junk DNA really is the junk in the DNA. So in your individual DNA, you have junk genomes.
No, we don't. We have strands that are not connected.
Well, it's more the case that these were thought to be vestiges of the evolutionary process, whereby as one organism, you know, passes its DNA onto its progeny, there are mutations, which is the very heart of descent with modification, and some of those mutations are very good and lead you to places where you can get much more adaptable organisms. Some of them are bad and lead to people, you know, organisms dying before they go to
you have strands of DNA, right, which are not connected. When they are connected, you have greater and higher abilities. And I'm going to tell you this now. Some of the clairvoyants and the people who can see auras have got more of their strands of DNA than you have. And they have got these abilities that you don't have. You don't have them, right, because we're not ready yet. They will be switched on when we're ready and when we understand. The rest of us, we are limited conscious. We're limited in our consciousness to the five senses, and those are very limited in their scope, right? You can look at things and see things, but you don't get the full information. Right. I mean, this is all gone from the Temple of Abydos. We've just gone a million times around.
That's fine. I really love the fact that we're sprawling into lots of different areas. I think it's
It's all connected. There's nothing that's not connected. So if somebody comes and says, I don't want to talk about that, they don't want to talk about that because, of course, they can't talk about that. That's the reason they don't usually want to. What you need to do is look at everything and be prepared to look at everything and understand it. Let me tell you a few things about some of the aspects, right? We have a story, we call it The Wizard of Oz, right? And that's the rise of consciousness. You come to this planet, what do you come to this planet for? You don't come to amass millions and millions of dollars because you can't take it with you. There's no pockets in shrouds. People who come to this world and understand that suddenly realize that it's not the physical effort that you gain through your lifetime that is of benefit to you, only in that one lifetime. Now, The Wizard of Oz teaches you what you come to look for. You start on a spiritual path, a spiral of energy. The spiral of energy is the golden spiritual path. The yellow brick road represents this. The yellow brick road takes you through all of your chakras and dimensions. I assume you're fully aware what chakras are.
Yes, okay. And I think we'll not go too much into that, otherwise it will be a very long show, I think.
Okay, well, we'll go on this last. What I would like to say is that if you went to university today, they wouldn't allow you in unless you can read and write.
Hmm.
Okay? You understand that?
Yeah.
So you have to have a basic understanding. You can't enter the yellow brick road of life unless you can explain what the Fibonacci spiral is. So you've got to have basics. Right. In the yellow brick road of life, you travel along life and you learn things. And you learn it with your companions. And the companions you have is a tin man, a lion, and a scarecrow, which represents the lion who's looking for courage, the tin man who's looking for a heart, and the scarecrow who's looking for a brain. So in your journey through life, in your experiences, you've come here to learn courage, wisdom, and heart, which you can take with you when you leave your body, which is only a computer. Your body is a genetically engineered computer, and it holds the essence of you as an orb in the throat, which is in a higher vibrational frequency than you can see, because your mind has been deactivated and reduced to the five senses, and those are incredibly limited in their sense. Okay?
But even the notion of five senses is something. So I think we keep coming across individual.
There are many more senses than five, but we're limited to those five senses.
Well, I mean, I don't think we are. I think we have, you know, you have a sense of
balance.
I know we're not.
I'm telling you, we're not limited to five senses. But on the present time, on this planet, in the evolution system that we're working on, we're basically limited to those five senses. It's people who've got a higher brainwave activity who see other levels and aspects in the higher frequencies, above the range of the eyes and ears, and the standard understanding of people. They're the ones who become the ones which, of course, you attack savagely as skeptics. You say, this person's channeling and speaking to somebody. And you say, no, because you can't hear what they're hearing. You can't hear what they're hearing, because their sight is to higher and lower in both ear and light sight, of higher frequencies and lower frequencies than you're tuned to. You're tuned in to the standard three frequencies. A human being is like a radio. You switched on to one channel. You can hear that one channel, but there are many other channels in the same space at the same time being broadcast differently. And some of the more advanced people can pick up information that's in those channels that you can't.
And is therefore, I think it's therefore really imperative. If that's absolutely true, and we can accept that as an idea that this is a hypothesis that may prove true. So we need to now prove it true. And I think
yes.
This is maybe where the misunderstanding that many people have of skepticism, and also maybe the difference between perhaps the your worldview and mine, is that when we now say, okay, we believe that there are people who can tune into these higher vibrations and higher frequencies and can demonstrate.
Of course they can. People can tune in. I've got people who can see auras, right? Can see somebody's aura. We can then sit that person in front of a Kirillian camera and take a photograph of that aura.
Well, we can, but the problem is the Kirillian camera doesn't photograph auras. We're aware of what the camera photographs, and it's more to do with electricity than anything else.
What do you think everything that works in the mind is? You're an electromechanical. You are an electrical being, right?
Well, that's
every
that's...
aspect that's in you moves from light, and light produces by frequency, produces electromagnetic. You are an electromagnetic being.
Well,
every part of you, all your muscles, all send information by minute pulses of electricity and light. That's what the thing is. You, that's what you are. You're made up of all them things, parts and pieces.
Well, that's absolutely true, but we know that because we're able to demonstrate that through testimony.
Okay.
Test
and can I give you an overall view as why there are things that you can't hear and see?
Yes, I think that'd be a great place to end it, actually.
Okay.
So if we use this to
I think that'd be a good one to start. This is a very, very important one. We'll go back to science. Science tells you there's only a vibration. Everything's a vibration. That vibration, according to the scientists, manufactures in energy. Energy then becomes two things, and two things only, please note this, light and sound. And every single thing that we can hear, feel, see, touch or perceive exists in any of our five senses is only combinations of light and sound in different vibrations and different frequencies. That's all there is.
What becomes of matter?
Light and sound. Everything. That's all. This is what your scientists are telling you at the highest levels. That all there is light and sound. So now we'll investigate that in its point. Light. If you were to stand outside in bright sunlight, of the known light wave frequencies, how much would you see?
A very narrow band.
Right. Of the known light wave frequency, we see 3%. So 97% of what's going on around you, you're not aware of. That's your best sense. Your next one is sound. As a known, and if you don't think so, let me tell you, if you came to our exhibition, you'd be underground, and if I turned all the lights out, you would disappear. But I can prove those light frequencies above and below easily by giving you ultraviolet or infrared glasses. And you would immediately see vibration levels and frequencies beyond the range of your eyes. Okay? Simple. Sound. Now, we are told, of the known frequencies of sound, we only hear 4%. So in reality, to what's standing around you, you're 96% short of the information being able to be transmitted to you. You are not aware of 96% of what's going on around you all of the time. Now, then you start to realize there is much more than you are sensing. Because you're limited to the five senses, and those five senses are very limited in the scope that we know that exists.
Well, that is true, but I think the fact that we know that we only see 3% of
light. Okay, light, so what else is there?
No, but
for
I think
people.
If I could just finish on that one point,
yeah.
The fact that we know we only see 3% of light was because we know we can detect the other 90% of light through things that aren't our own eyes. We have apparatus. We have the ability.
No, we
to
can't detect.
Light.
We can't detect the 97%. We can only detect a small amount of it. And that's up to certain levels, because our technology is not yet received in more. They assume, our scientists assume that they can detect all these other levels, because you'll find an odd frequency that we can pick up, which we know must have a variation between the two to give you a full picture.
But even if that was the case, the inferences and assumptions are based on replicable effects. We have, the
okay,
maths proves that.
Yes,
there.
Replicable effects, we can tell you that. So straight away, as a skeptic, you now know that the human being cannot see more than 3% of the known light wave frequencies. So there's 97% of those frequencies that can exist above and beyond the range of your eyes and ears. And that's the reality. And they do exist in those other dimensions of frequency. And once you detach or reattach your strands of DNA, you'll be able to hear and see. And at the same time as you start attaching your strands of DNA, you'll start to activate more parts of your mind. More parts of your mind. And you then will start to sense the other beings exist in a higher frequency in and around us. Now that's the end of you wondering what ghosts are. That's the end of your poltergeist. Because those are other beings living in a higher frequency in the same space at the same time. Right? And there you've got me. Now I'm going to tell you it breaks into 12 levels. There are 12 levels of frequency. And they come to sound. You see, the harmonics of sound break up into 12 harmonics, of which we normally only hear 8.8 octave. And then light breaks up into 7 major levels. That produces the levels of physicality. Light slowed down becomes solid. You slow the vibration frequencies of light, it breaks up into, again, 12 levels. And our consciousness and us, we are down in the four lower ones, in the four lower bodies, which make up you. Earth, fire, air, and water, which are also represented to physical, etheric, astral, and mental, which creates a physical reality in a body in combinations of light and sound. And that's the level that we are at. That's us. That is as we are now. And that's every single thing that we can see in this dimension all around us. There are 12 levels. There are 12 dimensions of existence. We exist as a physical being in the four lower ones. Right? We also exist in the higher ones, in higher levels of consciousness. And for us to be able to be aware and to see into those worlds around us, like the clairvoyants, the psychics, the mediums, the channelers, they hear and see into those higher levels, the genuine ones do, right? And then you've got other people who want to make money out of it, who will then twist it, but you've got the reality. What you've got to understand is you are here to learn courage, wisdom and heart on your spiritual path of your life, not to amass millions of pounds. You've got to learn the lower sections, your red chakra, the root at the base, represents me. The me aspect of your mind. Me, 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 me. That's what a baby thinks of when it comes on the planet. Just itself. And then as you evolve in consciousness, you reach the orange chakra, which is your desires. And you're here to master your desires. And if you can master your desires, you're a far better person who just lives in the me. So you're living your me, myself, and I. And here, once you've mastered your desires, and you realize that every desire creates an equal and opposite force of destruction. Every desire, right, reaches a level that permeates everywhere. There's an equal amount of suffering on the planet as every single desire. So when somebody has a desire, you must make sure it's not relevant or imposed upon anyone else. Because when you have a desire, there's an equal amount of suffering to balance it. Because in reality, everything's balanced. So your lower chakra's me, your next one up, your orange chakra, your desires. You need to learn to control your desires for no destruction. Then you move to the I am that I am. This is when you take your own power back. This is your solar plexus, your mind. This is where your consciousness is in your solar plexus. Your own grand central sun consciousness. And that interlinks it perfectly. So your grand central sun consciousness in the middle, right, is what controls all of your understanding. And here you become discerning. So you no longer believe what other people tell you without checking the evidence. To look for evidence, information, to back up what you're being told. And that's the I. Me, myself, and I. These are all lower physical relations to ourselves. That's the devil in us. That's the real devil. There is no devil. That's the devil when we think only of ourselves. And all of a sudden, when you reach the eye and you start to look around and you see how everything's right, you start to share, you become a responsible person. And I meet people, I say to them, who's responsible for what you say, think and do? And those that say, me, I am, then I say, well, you've grown up and you've taken the responsibility for your actions. When other people come along to me and say, no, God's responsible for what I say, think and do, I turn around and say, no, you have given your responsibility to another being that you would like to believe is a better being. You have given your power away because you are responsible for everything you say, think and do. And now as we raise up the chakras and we get into the throat and there are higher levels, we're now becoming a better evolved being. That's what you're on this planet here to do. To raise your vibrations, to become a social being, to activate your mind and become part of everything else, to understand who and what you are. As we raise our vibrations through our understandings. So as you reach a higher level, become a more godlike being when we're prepared to share and understand.
Well, David, I've really been fascinated talking to you. I think this will be an interview our listeners really enjoy, but I think we're just about out of time, so I think we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for being on the show, and I wish you all the best with the exhibition and your work.
You're welcome. I'm sorry to say that I'd like to talk to you more because you've hardly scratched the surface of what I believe is what we should all know. And I'm just building a new exhibition on the promenade, which will be open soon. And we have got one that's open, but we're going to make a much bigger one, much easier to access, and we'll be able to come. That will give us a full work into the universe. And I would be delighted to spend any time and talk to you about any subject you'd like.
Well, if our listeners are interested, that's Blackpool Promenade. If you're able to get along, I'm sure they'll be interested to pop by and say hi.
Okay. I look forward to meeting them all. And you. Thank you for the interview.
Be Reasonable is a production of the Merseyside Skeptic Society, featuring Michael Marshall. To find out more, visit merseysideskeptics.org.uk/podcasts. The theme music was by Dan Thomason. Find more of his work at danielthomason.com.